Let me start off with you, Roger, and ask you about this book, Government and the Sports Business. What is it you're out to do?
In American society, there is a great deal of mythology and sentimentality surrounding the operations of sports. Most people don't like to think of it in terms of the business, and in fact, the management of sports enterprises often say that only they can understand the intricate operations of the industry. I think part of the book was to treat with respect the sentimentality and the mythology. It's something that I share, in fact.
What do you mean you share it?
I'm a sports fan. I like to go out and see people like Frank Ryan throw the football 65 yards, and I like to see even baseball games.
Does that mean that sports shouldn't be criticized, or the institutions of sports
shouldn't
be
criticized? Not at all. That's the whole point of the book, is to show that one can believe that sports is a worthwhile activity at the professional level. One can enjoy the artistic nature of the game. But at the same time, one can use conventional tools of economic and legal analysis to look at the institutional operations of the industry and suggest ways in which those institutional operations could be changed so that the industry would do a better job of providing sports to the sports fan.
Now, Frank, you are now a mathematician. You have a PhD in math. But you remain a football fan and a sports fan in general.
Yes, I'm particularly a football fan, and I enjoy watching the way the various new endeavors in sports are coming up. And I generally have a positive view towards these things. I think that most of the changes that I've seen, the ripples in the water have had a overall net effect of good.
For a long time, the player was regarded as a kind of slave, wasn't he? In fact, I think the word nigger was used, whether they were white or black.
Well,
or
I wouldn't
nigger.
Blame that on sports. But I wouldn't quite use the word slave.
What do you call it when somebody owns somebody else and only he can sell him or buy him, and the individual
well,
has no
word? Well, I think
no
your choice
about.
Of words are wrong here, Stephen. Professional football owner does not own the player. He constrains where that player can operate as a player.
Do you limit it to football for some reason?
Well, no, but of course I think the constraints in baseball are even stronger.
That's
and
right.
I'm not really familiar with what the player management relationships are in other sports like hockey and basketball.
Well, maybe Roger can enlighten us.
Well, yeah,
us
the
here.
Sports make a great deal in the public relations sense about the differences in their systems. That baseball, in theory at least, baseball has a unlimited reserve system. That is to say, once a player signs a contract, he is must forever be playing for that team unless that team chooses to let him go or to trade him.
Well, in that light, do you still think, Frank, that my choice of words was incorrect?
Yes, I do.
I think it's incorrect, too. I think that slavery is just too emotive and loaded a term to describe a situation.
The players themselves have used it.
Well, that's so let them. I mean, I don't have to agree with the players either. I think that the appropriate way to look at the player reservation system, whether it is the baseball system or the relatively liberal, the most liberal of all the systems is the one in basketball, and then you have stages in between for the other sports, simply to say that players at a professional major league level are people with exceptional gifts. They're like movie stars or even good radio broadcasters. They're people who have a particular talent for pleasing other people. Unlike the situation in the other entertainment industries, they operate in an institutional environment which prevents them from capturing the full economic value of that gift. If there is no reserve system among the motion picture studios for controlling the income of Paul Newman, there is nothing to prevent James Michener from collecting the full value of his next novel. However, when a ball player like Henry Aaron or a football player like Frank Ryan rises to the top of his profession, he does not get the full economic value inherent in that talent, because the teams in the leagues are prevented by league rules from competing for his services. He must bargain as on a one-to-one basis with the team that holds his contract. And that isn't slavery by any stretch, because they are paid very high wages, certainly far above the wage necessary to keep them healthy enough to be able to play their sport. But at the same time, their mobility is limited.
Let me interject a sidelight here to perhaps support what Roger's saying. A player signs a contract. I'm thinking now particularly of professional football players with management to perform over a period of time. When that contract expires, it must be renegotiated. And there's now a mechanism that exists within the Professional Football League to negotiate with another owner so that, in fact, the owner, the original owner, does not control completely the affairs of the player. He can leave. Now, I think in baseball, perhaps it's a little bit stronger, and all I could offer there is that the baseball player who signs a lifetime contract is probably ill-advised to begin with.
Well, you're talking about 100% of baseball players, then, aren't you?
That's right, but I think the
football player's situation is not all that good either. I mean, granted, he has more mobility, and what the option system in football allows you to do is get out of a psychologically difficult position or get out of a situation in which you are being grossly underpaid in relation to other football players of similar ability. But because of the Roselle rule, which means that the team that signs you away from another team must compensate the original team, because of that, the existence of that compensation, the player is still prevented from receiving his full value.
I think what you're saying, tell me if I'm wrong, is that professional athletes, particularly football and baseball, because that's what we've been talking about, are both paid too much and paid too little. Paid too much because certain individual stars, such as Henry Aaron, have kind of upfront salaries that demonstrate the value and the worthiness of the team. On the other hand, the rookie or the less heralded player can be exploited by management. And I'm reminded, I'm not sure if it's entirely relevant, of what Babe Ruth said when he was told that he was making more money than the President of the United States, and he replied, well, I had a better year than he did.
It seems to me that what Roger is getting at is the fact that management would perhaps exploit across the board, whether they were the good stars or the mediocre players, rookies.
When you pay an obscene amount of money, like $250,000 a year.
Well, I don't think that's obscene. It depends on how many times you're getting knocked down.
You should know.
I was never paid that amount either.
What was the highest salary you ever got?
Let me see if my NFL contract will allow me to say. I was making over $100,000 when I quit.
Well, you must have been getting knocked down a lot for that.
Last year you didn't get knocked down.
Not at all. I got in the game for one play my entire last year in professional football. So.
But you wanted to comment on this business of what I call...
Yes, I would almost invert what you said. I suspect that if you were going to measure the difference between what the market salary would be and what the actual salary is in professional sports, that the marginal player is very closer to getting what he is worth, in quote-unquote, in terms of his economic value to the team.
Yeah, and you figured this out in a kind of complicated mathematical, statistical way.
That's right. One of the chapters in the book goes into the factors that determine the value of a player to a team, and in estimating a statistical relationship between attendance at games and the quality of the team, including the presence of superstar players. In professional baseball, for example, since you referred to Henry Aaron, we defined a star in baseball as someone who had played on 5 All-Star teams. And one of the factors that we used to explain the attendance at games was the number of such stars playing on a team. And we came to the conclusion that the number of stars you get from this measure is a little more than 1 per team. So there were on the order of 30 stars in professional baseball to do our analysis with. We came to the conclusion that those 30 players, on average, were worth over $200,000 apiece to their teams in terms of the net increase of gate receipts that they caused by playing. Well, there are not 30 baseball players earning $200,000. What that leads you to conclude is that a player like Henry Aaron, despite the fact he's been being paid $250,000 a year, is in fact worth a lot more than that in all probability, because players who you would not recognize quite so clearly would still average on average be worth $200,000.
After Henry Aaron hit his record-breaking home run, something like 25% of the fans got up and didn't watch the rest of the game.
That's right.
And the next game he played in was not particularly well attended.
Yeah, same thing is true with when Sandy Koufax was at the end of his career. The Dodgers averaged 7,000 or 8,000 fans a game more when Sandy Koufax was pitching than when anybody else was pitching. It is simply true that that just like the movies where people go to see Paul Newman or Robert Redford as much as they go to see a movie called The Sting that won an Academy Award, the same thing is true in baseball, that a very substantial fraction of the fans in a baseball game are there to see Henry Aaron or one of the other current superstars. They are not there to watch the contest per se, as the Aaron incident demonstrates. By the end of that game, the fans were empty, even though the Atlanta Braves were winning.
Yeah, Roger, I wanted to ask you to say a word more about the fact you talked about defining a star as somebody who's played in 5 All-Star games. But one of the things that your book does, and as far as I know, it's the first time, is you are using the social scientist tools on sports. Is it, in fact, the first time?
Well, there have been some isolated examples. Professor at the University of Massachusetts by the name of Simon Rottenberg, as far as I know, was the first person to use economic analysis to analyze professional sports. He wrote an article about 20 years ago in which it was a theoretical piece in which he was able to demonstrate that the presence of a reserve clause would not contribute anything to the balance of competition, which is the traditional argument that has been used to defend the restrictions on movements of players among teams, the competition for players. That defense by the leagues has always been that if individual owners were permitted to hire players at will, that a few rich owners who have a great thirst for winning would hire all the good players and win every game by scores of 142-3 or something of that order.
Yeah, well, Frank...
Cy Rottenberg could have come to any other conclusion but that one.
Well, he came to the conclusion that the basic idea, which is repeated in the book in a far more sophisticated fashion by two people who wrote chapters of the book, James Quirk and Mohammed El-Hodiri, who did the same kind of model, and what they did is say if one assumes that an owner tries to maximize the profitability of his operations, then there is no reason to become of that great strength as a team because the fan interest in the team diminishes if the team gets too strong. That is to say, if a team gets so strong that every single game is one-sided, fans lose interest.
Let me ask you if this was true when the New York Yankees were going through their perennial year after year championship.
Well, the point being, I think the important point, Frank, is that if something happens like the Yankees, it will happen independent of the existence of a reserve clause. The Yankees became a dominant force in the American League during a period in which the ball players had the minimum amount of strength they have ever had.
Yes, there was no draft that selected the baseball players in those days, were there?
No, but there was trades and sales.
The Yankees did have a lot of money.
Well, there was if you recall, that the claim was made that the reason the Yankees were doing so well is that there were other clubs in the American League that were essentially acting as farm teams for the Yankees. That they were what the reserve clause does. It says that the person who shall capture the benefit, the economic value of the player, shall be the owner and not the player. And one way the owner can capture that is to sell the player to another team. And in fact, that is what happens in baseball. That on the order of 50 players a year in professional baseball are sold. Their contracts are sold from one team to another. And the way that the Yankees remained a perennial powerhouse in the 40s and 50s and early 60s was by buying players from the less well-off teams, like the St. Louis Browns and the Kansas City Athletics. The same thing is true now of the Dodgers. The Dodgers are probably about the best-managed team in professional baseball. And one way they continually are close in a pennant race, but rarely running away with it, is because they very carefully measure the strength of their team. And when it gets a little too low, they go out and they acquire new players to purchase.
And do they want to make sure they don't get too good also? Are you
yes,
implying
that's
that?
The point. The Yankees were too good, and they destroyed interest in not only in themselves but the league. The American League at the time of the Yankee dynasty started was a far more popular league in terms of attendance than the National League. By the time the Yankee Dennis dynasty was coming to a close, the National League was drawing 50% more fans than the American League.
That may be true, but how were the Yankees drawing?
The Yankees were not drawing well, and they have.
The Yankees are very vulnerable.
Were drawing very well in the late 40s and early 50s, but by the time their dynasty ended, they were not drawing well at all.
Well, of course, their dynasty could be a great cause.
No, I mean
there,
when they were still winning.
When they were
pennants,
winning, you're saying that their attendance was going
declining,
down.
Declining, yes.
And that's also, as soon as the Mets became anything like an interesting baseball team, there is a residue, I think, of resentment toward the Yankees, and everybody flocked over to Shea Stadium to watch the Mets. Well, I wanted to pick you up, Roger, on the subject about the Dodgers. Can you give us an example of how the Dodgers downgraded their own team in order to produce more competition in the league?
Well, during the 50s, the Dodgers had a proclivity for signing first-class shortstops, and they were populating professional baseball with shortstops. The Branch Rickey really is a man who really changed the face of baseball by developing the farm system, and first with the St. Louis Cardinals and then with the Brooklyn Dodgers. He developed very strong farm systems where not only did those farm systems make those two teams strong relative to the rest of the league, but they provided a substantial source of income for those teams in the selling of players to other teams. And if one in the late 50s and early 60s, if one went around the league and looked at major league rosters, one would find Dodger infielders on virtually every team.
Well, can you think of a specific example in which Rickey or some other management mogul said, we've got to make our team a little bit worse than it is right now?
Yeah. Oh, that would never be public. I mean, can you imagine what the fans would do?
Well, can you read into it? Can you think of an example in which you think that
happened? Well, I think it's an absurd concept. Yeah. I cannot management purposely destroying the very product that they've got.
And yet you maintain, Roger, that happened.
Yeah, what about the cases in the late 50s when the Kansas City Athletics were providing the Yankees with a steady supply of outfielders?
Well, you said earlier that they needed money.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's the point.
But I'm saying that if you're on top and if you've got these good athletes and if you've got money, you're not going to give them away just for the goodness of it.
You're saying that competition is the be-all and the end-all, and that the Dodgers and maybe some other teams were giving away some of their edge in order to have more competition.
I don't think it's so much giving it away as managing the team in such a way that it's a contender.
And
not running away with things. I think that's the key. The only real exception to that in the history of baseball has been the Yankees, and that the only case of a team that perpetually sought to win the league by as many games as possible was the Yankees, and it succeeded in undermining the financial health of the team and the league in so doing. And
do you accept that, Frank?
Well, I think the premise is wrong. They did not give players away to improve league-wide competition.
Or even
there
sell
were
them.
Other motives for selling players and trading players, but it was not the motive to improve
the
competitive
the same,
quality
Frank.
Of other players. It might have happened naturally.
Oh, I think we're on loggerheads. We're on loggerheads here.
I think management was motivated that way.
I think the interesting point
they would never
here.
Say that. Well, I think let me say that the motive to improve the competition of the league and the motive to sell a player because he's worth more in the open market than he is playing for the team are identical. That is to say, if you can get $300,000 for the contract of a player, and you look at his value to your own team, well, what you're thinking of as that value is, well, how many extra games are we going to win because of him? How many extra fans are going to come to the game because we have this player on the roster?
Right.
And you say, well, is that worth $300,000? Now, what is that $300,000 measures? Well, that measures the value of that same player on somebody else's roster in terms of games won, in terms of fans brought to the park.
Well,
so to sell a player because he can get a higher price than his value to you is exactly the same as to sell him because he will increase the competitive balance of the league.
Those
are identical concepts.
I think what we have not spelled out here in our conversation so far, but it is spelled out in the book, mm-hmm. is that there is no complete correlation between the excellence of a team and the excellence of the business that team does. That in fact a winning team it can be expected to do better business at the box office than a losing team, but there is
a point beyond which if they improve themselves even more, Well, to improve your team beyond that level will have higher costs in terms of more players at higher salaries, and it will have decreased revenues because fans will lose interest in the team.
You say at one point in the chapter about hockey that if your winning record is 10% higher, then you can predict 1,000 more fans per game.
Right. We do that for all the sports, actually, is to estimate the relationship between the winning record and the attendance at the game. And
if you 100% of your games and the attendance goes
right,
down.
Right. Well, in fact, nobody ever wins 100% of their games. Within the realm of the years that we investigated, there no team won so frequently that we could detect a turndown in their attendance as a consequence of their winning. There was nobody in the period that we were analyzing, which is late 60s and early 70s, that ran away with their league so completely. It was nothing like the Yankee dominance of the 50s going on at that period in any of the professionals.
And in hockey, you factor in the mean temperature of the city. How does that...
Yes. Well, one of the things that we were concerned about was the possibility that hockey is a regional sport. Everyone knows that in Canada or in Boston, some places that tend to be cold weather places, people are insane about hockey. At the same time...
Wait, do you use that word advisedly, insane? Do you think they really are insane?
I was using that in a purely journalistic and literary sense. No, I don't think there's anything wrong with someone enjoying a hockey game so much that they get all excited about it. That's if that's the way they want to turn on, let them turn on that way. What I was talking about is that the intensity of interest, the desirability of watching a hockey game to the sports fan in the area, appears to be really enormous in a few of these cities. When I was a graduate student at Harvard in the early 60s, the Boston Bruins were a really atrocious hockey team. They were way at the bottom of the National Hockey League. Yeah, and at the same time, the Boston Celtics were winning everything in the National Basketball Association. But the Boston Bruins were sold out every single game in the Boston Garden, and no matter who the Celtics were playing, you could always get a ticket. And they were averaging 5,000 or 6,000 fans a game fewer than the Boston Bruins.
But doesn't that screw up your nice little mathematical formula here?
Not at all. All it says is that there's a lot of demand for hockey and there's not much demand for basketball in Boston. Now, the reason for the temperature variable and for some of the other things that are really standing in for regional differences in these various estimates is to try to correlate this intensity of interest, to try to figure out why is there such intense interest in hockey in New York and Boston, Chicago, places like that. But at the same time, on television, hockey cannot draw flies. In fact, one of the more fascinating features of hockey on television is that it gets slightly lower audience ratings than televised fishing. NBC had a disaster last year when it put the Stanley Cup playoffs on primetime television. It literally drove the audience away in droves. Well, how can you capture this? Well, we've decided that it's likely that hockey has specialized regional interest. And so when we put this temperature variable into this equation, we found that, in fact, it is true that in cold weather climates, the attendance at hockey games is much greater than in warm weather climates. Well, I suspect that arises from the presence of amateur sport and the people are socialized to some extent, I suppose, to like a sport in their childhood. And in the South and in the West Coast, children are not brought up to play hockey, whereas in cold weather climates, they are brought up to play hockey. And consequently, their understanding of the game and their interest in the game is probably much higher.
What do you mean when you say only in hockey can the public, that is to say the number of fans, be measured relative to the playoff race?
Oh, yes. One of the things that we tried to do was capture the effect on attendance in hockey of their peculiar playoff system, which was, as you know, the Stanley Cup playoffs are really the objective of the hockey season, not the regular season. Other sports have adopted the playoff mechanism, but only in hockey can you really measure its effect. In football, most all seats are sold on a season ticket basis, so that you wouldn't get any additional attendance during the course of the season because a team was or was not in contention for the playoffs. By the time you learn that your team is going to be a contender for the playoffs, it's too late to make a decision about buying tickets. That ticket has to be made before the season starts. That decision has to be made before the season starts because all the seats are sold on a season ticket basis. In basketball, the playoffs are much less excitement and meaningfulness because rarely is there ever a doubt as to who's going to make the playoffs. In the season that just finished, there was one playoff spot that was in doubt at the end of the season. That was the representative from the Western Division of the National Basketball Association, whether it was going to be Los Angeles or San Francisco. But aside from that, there wasn't a single playoff spot that was in doubt by the first of the year. And the same thing is true normally in professional basketball. So there again, there isn't a closeness of competition to get into the playoffs. You pretty much know whether your team has a chance by a few weeks after the season starts. But in hockey, because the teams in the center of the league are better balanced than in basketball, and because there are some tickets available, they're not completely sold out on a season ticket basis, you can measure the sensitivity of attendance to closeness in the race. And one of the amazing factors that we found was that it is slightly better for you to be in contention for fourth place than in contention for first place. That is to
more
have
fans.
Yeah, that's right. In other words, if a team is right on the borderline between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs, the fans are more likely to turn out than if the team is winning the league. For somehow it generates interest in the team to have it be have a great deal of uncertainty attached to whether it is going to actually make the playoffs.
Yeah, Frank, you have anything to say about hockey?
No, I didn't play hockey when I was a kid, and I don't watch it on television, so I'm sort of a...
You watch fishing.
That's right. And I did fish when I was a kid. That's right.
But what about the... I was going to use the word violence. I'm not sure if that's the proper word. What about the very heavy physical contact in hockey? Is that responsible to some extent for its popularity?
Well, I think football was certainly regarded as a sport with physical contact. I don't think that you have to have physical contact in order to be a popular sport.
Isn't it true that hockey is the fastest growing sport today in North America?
It is the fastest growing if you measure it by the extent of amateur hockey, but remember, it's growing from nothing. There are far fewer amateurs playing hockey than playing any of the other four, any of the other three major professional sports.
And what about box lacrosse, which is another Canadian import and which is advertised very straightforwardly as come and watch somebody get belted?
Well, the roller derby is popular too. There undoubtedly is a demand for that.
To be saying, well, we can't measure that with our statistical tools.
I don't know how. It is somewhat easy to say for teams in a given sport, in a given league, in a given competitive arrangement, how will the teams differ in their attractiveness? That is relatively easy to do, and that's what's done in the book. What is extremely difficult to do, and I am certainly not qualified to do it, is to say, try to explain why people find a particular sport more or less attractive than another.
Yeah. Given the fact, as you point out, that hockey is the only sport in which the drawing power of the playoff race can be measured, what can you extrapolate from hockey to explain what's going on in the other sports too?
Well, I think that one thing that comes through loud and clear from all of the work that we did is that a sport in which you can have close races and uncertainty of who the eventual champion will be is going to be more popular than a sport in which you do not have that circumstance.
Again, being excellent but not so excellent
is what
pays off the most.
Right, and the evidence you use to support
Frank,
that
you objected,
differs.
You objected to that before. You objected to Roger saying that owners and managers will strive for that kind of supreme.
They will not appreciate the economic theorem that Roger Noel announced earlier that equates their gift to other players with this sense of doing good for the whole league.
It just
They will, of course, in the National Football League, because there is a repayment when a player leaves one team. They naturally expect to get something back, and there's a regulation there. But in baseball, and the point we were making earlier, there was not this regulatory influence. So,
The sports fan who picks up this book because he wants to read about sports is going to have some rather heavy going. Frank, take a look at this page, will you? This is a theory.
Yeah, there you go.
This is a formula that Roger has got somewhere. that is designed to predict what the attendance of a Major League Baseball game will be if there is a Negro pitcher. And I think also if it's a doubleheader in July or something like that. But anyway, I give it to you because you're a mathematician and you know something about math. And I don't know what my question is here, but what happens when you've got all these kind of these numbers defining human beings?
Is it, I don't know. Just right off the top, this looks like some type of weighted sum. And it certainly is a model for some theory that that supports it. I'm not so sure how far you can go with formula. I much more appreciate the types of theorems that that Roger announced that I referred to just a minute ago. Mathematics is limited in some of its aspects.
Well, without being a mathematician, I think that was my reaction too, that there's only so far you can go with math.
Yeah.
This isn't math, incidentally. It's what... what the page that you handed to Frank is a statistical analysis. The numbers in that are not derived through mathematical manipulation from the midair. What happened was that
maybe you could read us just perhaps not as much as a whole line.
Well, I wouldn't call this mathematics either.
Give us an example.
Arithmetic. Yeah.
That's right.
It's a trivial formula.
Yeah, it's trivial, that's right. What the formula does is tell you, on the average, how many fans attended a baseball game in an actual season. I forget which particular season it was, but it was in the late 1960s sometime.
Well, would you read
and
us,
the,
Roger?
The attendance, well, the formula set gives you a constant number, which is 24,574, which happens to be the average attendance of the team that won the pennant that year, the St. Louis Cardinals. And then it says that then you have a series of differences from 24,574, depending upon which other team it was whose attendance you were measuring. So it says 24,574 plus 4,473 San Francisco. What that means is that if the team you're interested in is San Francisco instead of St. Louis, that their average attendance for the year was the sum of 24,574 plus 4,473. It does this for each of the teams in the league.
Well, what's the function of the Negro pitcher?
Well, finally, you get through with the which team it was that was playing, whether you were where in the year you were playing, whether it was a doubleheader or not, whether it was a night game or a day game, whether it was a weekend game, and finally, at the end, you have whether the hometown starting pitcher was black or white. The purpose of this is to find out, did attendance on average differ when the hometown pitcher was black compared to when he was white? The reason for this is that the only aspect of the starting lineup that is publicized in advance in baseball is, in fact, who the starting pitcher will be. If you look in the morning paper today...
But they don't publicize whether he's black or white.
No, but we presume that a fan knows that. That is implicit in the
model.
I'd
say that's a strong presumption.
Well, but that's
some
a hypothesis.
Cases.
No,
but some
that's a hypothesis we're testing, Frank. It's not. We're not assuming it. We're hypothesizing it and testing to see if it comes out to be the case. So we then say, okay, if a fan wanted to discriminate, we're not assuming that he necessarily does, if a fan wanted to discriminate, if he wanted to choose which game to attend on the basis of the race of the players involved, he could at least in principle find out the race of the starting pitcher. So by adding this other variable, was the starting pitcher black or white, to the attendance model, we get a result that slightly less than 2,000 fans per game fewer will show up on nights or days when a black is the starting pitcher for the home team instead of a white.
Therefore, a black is worthless in monetary terms to a baseball team.
If this result were to hold up...
I think that's awfully wrong assumptions to make on the basis of these facts, because after all, it may be that the population of black pitchers has much fewer good pitchers. And who wants to go out and see a bad pitcher pitch?
Yeah, unfortunately, the data on performance of pitchers in the professional baseball says the opposite, that blacks, on average, perform better than whites. And in the case of pitchers, there is another table in the book which shows that measured by earned run average or one-loss percentage or power pitching ratio, which is a ratio of strikes to walkouts, that black pitchers are better than white pitchers on average in professional baseball. So that, in fact, and it's also true that black pitchers are more frequently found on better teams. So all those things would predict that if there was no discrimination at all, that the presence of a black player ought actually to increase attendance because he's better.
And your book is claiming that this theory is borne out by the fact that owners take cognizance of this reality by paying black
yes.
players of equal ability less.
Yes. The author of this chapter, incidentally, on discrimination in baseball is Professor Gerald Scully at Southern Methodist. And this is not the only piece of evidence that he brings to bear here. He also did a very detailed and complicated statistical analysis of the salary structure of professional baseball, in which he collected information on the salaries of about 160 players. And he tried to explain differences among players in salaries on the basis of their performance, their batting average, their number of home runs, their fielding percentage, their stolen bases, and numerous other measures of the quality of the player, including the number of years of experience he had. And he found that if one takes two players of identical abilities measured by all these indexes of their qualities, and one is black and one is white, the white player earns more. He also found that the minimum entry requirements to maintain a position on a major league roster were higher for blacks than for whites. In other words, the minimum batting average that a black shortstop has to have in order to stay on the team is higher than the minimum batting average that a white shortstop would have to have.
And the presumed reason for this is simply that the owners recognize the reality in terms of attendance.
Well, there are two possible reasons that don't involve active discrimination by owners. Of course, one reason could be active discrimination on owners, but that certainly is not proven by this, and no attempt or claim to that regard is made. The two reasons that are offered in the chapter are, first of all, that in fact fans do discriminate. That is to say, attendance is lower if there are more blacks on a team.
Wasn't there one case in which all nine players on a major league team...
Yes, one time Pittsburgh fielded a team in which the entire squad was black. And in fact, historically, Pittsburgh has had more blacks on its roster than other teams, yes. So one explanation would be that. The other possible explanation revolves around the reserve clause, and that is, when a player's wage is determined by a bargaining process in which there's no competition, that the outcome depends in part on his skills, but it also depends in part upon his bargaining abilities and bargaining strengths. The black player, because of educational disadvantages relative to whites, because of less lucrative employment opportunities outside of sport, has a much weaker bargaining position than the white player. White players are more likely to have been to college, and they're more likely to have relatively good job opportunities outside of baseball.
Why is it, as is documented in this chapter, that the black player is more likely to play the outfield than the infield?
That was another intriguing investigation by Scully, and that he cut the pictures of all the black baseball players out of Ebony Magazine. Ebony Magazine every year publishes pictures of all the black Major League Baseball players. And he gave them to his statistics class when he was teaching a class in statistics, and had the class rate the players on their degree of blackness. And he found that there is a statistically significant and consistent relationship, that the further away a player is from home plate, the blacker he gets. That of the players who were given the highest ranking in degree of blackness, they were almost invariably outfielders, whereas the players that were more white...
You're talking about hues of skin.
Hues
of
skin color. That's right. That the players who physically came closer to looking like they were white were more likely to be pitchers, infielders, and catchers.
Yeah.
And again, he says this is another reflection in his mind, at least in one possible explanation of it. Could be, again, fan discrimination, because
When you were talking about how near you are to home plate...
That's right.
I guess the major consideration there is TV.
It's TV, plus it's also fans. That the most expensive seats are the ones that are surrounding the infield, and that it's probably, you know, the argument being that the closer the player is to the fan, the more likely he is to be of a light skin color, which would indicate, again, this other thing we talked a minute ago about in terms of pitchers, that fans would prefer to watch white players than
you
black
know,
players.
What you're saying now, it sounds to me like a kind of bombshell. And I wonder if when the statistics are investigated, and if it's found to be true, if it is true, if it will have any effect on professional sports.
I don't think so. If, in fact, the source of all this lies in the sports fans, that means it has a very deep... personal and psychological basis in the nature of a large number of people in American society, I can't imagine that anything could be done at an organizational level in professional baseball.
Let's switch our focus for a moment to football. Now let's ask our resident all-star quarterback whether any of the things that you have said, Roger, help to explain why so few professional quarterbacks are black.
Well, I don't have an explanation for that at all, and I'm sure that there are racial overtones somewhere embedded in the reasoning. And I am encouraged that breakthroughs have been made and balances are starting to be achieved. Do you have any statistics, Roger?
No,
that suggests,
let's talk about how close to the ball you get and how far away from the ball you get in football. Now, who gets the ball in football? The center, the quarterback, the ends?
And that's another interesting statistic. There weren't many black centers. Maybe that's because there were a lot of white quarterbacks. I don't know.
I know, we have not done a similar study for professional football.
But maybe we can just erect a postulate here on the basis of what we've been saying about baseball.
It's conceivable. I have my doubts about that in football the effect is as strong in terms of playing positions, because I think the identity of the player is more anonymous in football.
I think that the early argument about baseball suggests that that it was really a fan influence looking at a black players on the field. In football, it may be more subtle in that it's a management or a coach's influence that sort of partitions these players out.
Well, who has the most thankless jobs in football? I guess it's the guys who get knocked down a lot and who never get to see the football. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the ratio, the black-white ratio in those jobs?
Well, I don't have any statistics.
What's your feeling just from knowing a lot of these people?
A 50-50 sort of relationship.
In other words, the black population would be higher there than any other kind of job.
No, I think that you might find the black population relatively higher in the outside receiver positions and in the defensive back positions.
Yeah, of course, the running backs handle the ball, a great many of them are black, but of course it's a very rough job indeed, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think I can really comment on this because I don't have any statistics to support anything I might say.
Roger, well, we've been talking about a book called Government and the Sports Business, and we haven't said a great deal about government. What role should the government, be it the United States government or any other, play in regulating professional leagues? And particularly when you have an international sport such as hockey, what role can it play?
Well, it has already played a role that government has been responsible for lots of the restrictive practices that pervade in sports. And it turns out the one that I think is most important we haven't even talked about, which is the territorial exclusivity of franchises and the league's policies with regard to expansion and team movements, that the what government has said in a passive sense, they have done nothing to overturn the baseball exemption from the antitrust laws, which in the words of one Supreme Court justice has been said was not Justice Holmes' finest hour. The baseball stands alone in that it has been exempt now from antitrust laws ever since the 1921 decision case.
Bring this down to earth for us. What exactly does it mean when you say that baseball is exempt? What can baseball do that the grocery store owner on the corner can't?
Well, there are a number of things baseball can do. Or sports in general can do. Baseball is slightly better off than other sports. Before I answer that, I want to answer one other point first, and that is that the baseball exemption arises from a court case that has been passively accepted by the Congress, but Congress has actively participated in two other exemptions. One was in the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1962, in which Congress allowed teams to negotiate together as a unit rather than to compete with one another in the sale of broadcasting rights. And the other was the 1966 legislation, which gave the professional football leagues the right to merge without the merger having any antitrust implications. Now, what this means is, first of all, unlike the corner grocery store, they can have this strict control over the movement of their employees from employer to employer. They can separate the market for players, the number of players, into distinct categories, and each team has an exclusive right to bargain with the players in that category. The second thing that they can do is they can decide there's only one grocery store in town. They can create a monopoly. The only real check on that monopoly is that if they expand their own league so slowly that there are numerous cities available for professional sports, this professional sport in which they operate, then they always have the threat that a new league will be formed, which is what we've been observing lately. But still, that is a very, very loose check because of the established position of the existing league, its greater public acceptance, and the role of the sports writers, which they are always very conservative about the prospects of a new league and its quality of play. So it takes a while to start a new league to gain fan acceptance, usually 3 or 4 years.
And the franchises in a new league are simply dispersed by the formers of the new league.
That's right. And it still doesn't... of course, the new league has a tremendous incentive to put as many teams in places that have enough support for teams as it can, so that when new leagues are formed, usually there's a tremendous increase in the number of teams. They even force the old league to begin expanding also, which is... been the case in hockey and in basketball, that the old leagues expanded tremendously when the new leagues were formed.
But what role should the government play? After all, we're talking about some people who want to make a dollar.
All right.
Why should the government play any role at all except to say you can't have a monopoly? And when new leagues form,
I think that's an important question. Now, let's discuss what the government could do. One thing the government can do is rely upon the antitrust laws, which, of course, we've been doing for 50 years in a hit-and-miss way, and that just doesn't work, except the only place where the antitrust laws have worked in promoting the expansion of sports is that when new leagues do form, with the sole exception of the Federal League between the 1915 to 1920 period, with that sole exception, new leagues have always been successful in getting started by hiring away players from the established leagues, and the antitrust laws have protected them in that regard. But aside from the new league problem, there's just no way that you're going to have, say, a baseball team in Washington, D.C. as a consequence of antitrust action. Washington, D.C. is a city which could support a baseball team. It has people, it has at least three groups that I'm aware of
who are willing to pay. It didn't support the senators very well.
It supported them sufficiently to justify the presence of a team.
It didn't.
It most certainly did.
They went away.
That they certainly did go away, but it didn't have anything to do with.
In fact, they went away several times.
It didn't have anything to do with whether or not Washington, D.C. That's a terribly important point that you raise about why they go away. The point is there are fewer baseball teams than there are places where baseball teams ought to be. And that's why, like, Washington and San Diego competing for the Padres, or Washington and Arlington, Texas competing for the Senators, or in the old Minneapolis-Washington competition for the Senators. The point is that the reason people are so upset when a city loses a team is because it's so difficult to get another one. And whether their city can support a team or not is not the issue. The issue is whether, in the short run, an owner can do better for 2 or 3 years somewhere else, because owners tend to sell teams quite frequently, particularly the newer kinds of owners who are there mainly to take advantage of the tax loopholes.
But let me ask Frank at this point whether it isn't true that when the new teams proliferate, when new leagues come into being, whether the talent is not overly diluted, and as a result, the sport suffers and the fan suffers.
Well, I can't recall an instance when the quality of talent on established professional teams was diluted by giving mediocre players to the incoming clubs. Of course, incoming clubs had poor talent for number of years, but that's the price they pay to get into the league.
So you don't? Do you think that the sport is harmed, that the fans are harmed, that the game is harmed somehow?
By expansion?
Yeah.
Not at all. I think that if the economics warrant it, why not? As a matter of fact, the expansion of the National Football League led to the current playoff arrangement, where there is a layered playoff effect, and I think that's made it terribly more interesting, whereas before, when you had fewer teams, there wasn't really quite the compulsion to go towards that type of playoff arrangement.
But, Frank, one thing that Rogers suggests in his book, and I'm not sure whether he's saying this is his choice or whether it's just a possibility, is that government might step in and put a damper or a limit on the amount of money a new league can offer a player to jump. In other words, we recently had a case, I think it was Larry Zonko, who went from making something like $80,000 to something like $1 million. And that's a factor of, what, 12? And what Roger has said in his conclusions in the book...
$1 million over 3 years. The relevant comparison is he jumped by four. He went from $80,000 to $330,000.
Right. What you have suggested in the conclusions in the book is that it might have an interesting effect if the government said, well, you can't do it by more than twice.
No, that's not what the book says. The book does not say that a new league can't do that. What it says is, if Frank is right, that there exist owners of the world who, if you give them the opportunity, will hire every single good player in the sport, that the way to deal with that is to do it directly in a manner that balances the financial strengths of teams. And the way to do that is to say that no team's total salary payments to all its players on its roster can be more than 50% above the league average. Now, what the 50% number does for you is provide a large enough cushion so that there's plenty of room for growth in player salaries. It would not put an overall damper on the salaries of players because 50% of last year's average is still, 150% of last year's average is still a big number, and it's much, much greater percentage than the annual rate of growth of player salaries. Well, what that would do is mean that a given owner simply couldn't monopolize all the $200,000 a year players because he couldn't afford it. It wouldn't be within the budget limitation. And that was the way we felt that would be a far more effective way for controlling the balance of quality among teams if you wanted to do that than would be the current system of option clauses and reserve clauses and all the rest.
But doesn't either of you see the dangers or the unfortunate possibilities of government stepping in too much to sports?
Well, I think it would be unfortunate if it was over-regulated. But I can't comment because I don't have any vision in mind's eye of just what the government would do. I'm not really up on that. However, I would say that the current arrangement in the National Football League is one which has come up with well-balanced teams. And
somebody else who happens to have a lot of money or some friends with a lot of money, he says, well, look how much money the National Football League is making and how much excitement they're generating. I'd like a piece of that action. I think I'll start my own league.
Well, that's fine, and you'll get into competition between the leagues, and that's been the thing that's given a good boost to players' salaries since 1960.
Sacrosanct about the National Football League, and there's nothing sacrosanct about the American League or the National League in baseball, although many people seem to believe that there is.
Well, I don't.
I don't know. I don't think that people in general believe that there is anything, any great sanctity involved in the existing institutions.
Baseball, I think you're wrong.
Well, I if so, then I give an enormous degree of congratulations to the owners to sell that kind of.
Do you see any movement anywhere for a new?
Oh yes, there is in fact a new baseball league planned called the World Baseball Association.
They all call themselves World. Hockey, football, now baseball.
That's right. No, I think that I don't know whether it'll succeed or not, but nevertheless...
Well, now that you mention it strikes home. I think it'd be a team in Tokyo.
Yeah. That's right. They are thinking of there's enormous interest in baseball, as I'm sure everyone is aware, in Latin America and in Tokyo. And one of the things they have in mind is to have a truly international league. It turns out the World Football League originally had that plan too, but somehow it didn't materialize. I think that there are enormous problems in getting that started.
Well, now you get into intergovernmental problems.
Yes, well, I don't
which,
see...
Which, of course, is exemplified between Ottawa and Washington on the subject of hockey.
I think Frank expressed some skepticism, although he didn't go into it in great detail about tremendous amount of governmental regulation of sports operations. I think that any adjective you want to apply to the notion of establishing a federal regulatory commission for professional sports, it would be appropriate. Silly, ridiculous.
Well, I would agree with that.
That doesn't make sense at all, because in general, regulation at the federal level doesn't work very well anyway. But in any event, to impose it on something like sports, where the dollars involved are relatively small, but the emotions involved are relatively large, I think, an impossibility and an impossible assignment. I would certainly not recommend to anyone they ever accept a job as the federal regulatory czar for sports.
Well, are you encouraged by the fact that social scientists are now beginning to train their tools of scrutiny on the sports, which they really, in large part, have not done before, that the players are beginning to take matters into their own hands, and there have been strikes?
Well, I personally am a little bit encouraged by some of these directions.
Things are changing.
Things are changing. I hope, though, that we won't see professional sports played on artificial turf inside a dome stadium with artificial atmosphere. Computers calling the plays, and the theorems of economics controlling every movement off the field.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We've been talking with Roger Knoll, who is a professor of economics at the California Institute of Technology, and who is responsible. He's the editor of a book just out called Government and the Sports Business, a book that I think sports fans will want to certainly look through, although some of it, as I said before, is heavy. And Frank Ryan has been our other guest. Frank is now director of the House of Congress Information Systems, and of course he's best known, I think, not for that, but for the fact that he was an all-star quarterback with the Los Angeles Rams, the Cleveland Browns, and the Washington Redskins. Gentlemen, thank you very much for an interesting and, I think, unusual discussion. This is Stephen Banker in Washington.